Welcome back to State of Belief Radio. I'm producer Ray Kirstein. While Welton Gaddy is the voice of this program, State of Belief is a production of Interfaith Alliance. And so, although Welton might not be super eager to have us focus on him for a change, that's exactly what Interfaith Alliance is doing at its annual Walter Cronkite Faith and Freedom Award ceremony in New York City on Sunday, November 11th. You see, hosting this show every week is the least of Welton's worries. He's been president of Interfaith Alliance, based in Washington, D.C., for 15 years. And on top of that, he's the pastor for preaching and worship at Northminster Baptist Church in Monroe, Louisiana. Now, on this show, Welton usually asks compelling questions and then steps out of the way to let his guests have their say. But his Interfaith Alliance salutes both his leadership and his lifetime of work defending faith and freedom. We really wanted to get Welton Gaddy to talk about himself a little bit more. So, Welton, welcome to State of Belief Radio.
Thanks very much, Ray.
You know, you mention it occasionally in context, but you are an ordained Baptist minister. You spent years in leadership positions in the Southern Baptist Convention, and you come from a pretty conservative background. Would you talk about that history a little bit?
I'd be glad to. I grew up in a very fundamentalist home. The primary value was love. The result of that was acceptance. My mother and father were both very conservative Christians. My dad educated a little bit better than my mom. But the prevalence of love in the home and acceptance within the family was the foundation that allowed me to ask questions, to look into areas that not all my colleagues were looking into. And then when finding truth there or finding challenges there that deserved a response of change, being able to talk through that with my parents, knowing that it would not affect their love for me, knowing that they might have trouble with some of my thoughts and desires for actions, but that it would never put me outside their love. I was very fortunate to have tremendous teachers. One of the things that's ironic and most people don't know about the Southern Baptist Convention was that in the early days of that convention, when I was a member of it in the 60s and 70s and 80s, the institutions, the universities and the seminaries offered the very best of university education and theological education in the seminaries. I mean, our teachers, professors were equivalents to Union Seminary and the other great ones in the nation. And though the theology was often conservative, the vision of those people was broad. It was almost as if a conservative approach to the Bible produces a liberal approach to social issues. That's how I've found it. That's how I've experienced it. And actually, it is to that kind of vision of Scripture and society that I'm still committed.
So it almost parallels what we've heard some folks in the political world say over recent years, that they didn't leave, for example, the Republican Party, but it left them. Is that kind of the experience you had with the changes in the Southern Baptist Convention, and then you're having to move away from that?
Yeah, the changes that took place in the Southern Baptist Convention came primarily from outside the convention. I remember the very first year that I saw this beginning to take shape was when officers of the convention invited into the Resolutions Commission of the convention a representative of the Reagan White House. And that was a clear sign that things were changing because when I went to work for the Social Ethics Agency and the Southern Baptist Convention, working primarily in the realm of government and religion, there was that old mantra, though Baptists would have never called it a mantra, that religion and politics don't mix. And we saw that changing. Saw it changing rapidly. And the people that were facilitating the change were what I would call theological fundamentalists and political power brokers who knew that within an organization like the Southern Baptist Convention, there was the possibility of gaining a major block of voters for Republican values. When I came to Washington to be a part of the Interfaith Alliance, one of the first speeches I gave, interestingly enough, was to a group of Republicans. And Republicans were a major part of birthing the Interfaith Alliance. And I said to them, I remember well, that the same people that stole my denomination are the same people that are trying to steal the Republican Party, and you better watch out, because they used traditional language, but they misinterpreted it so that they could pull on the emotions as well as the traditions of people and label some as liberals and some as trusted conservatives. It was clearly never a theological movement. It was from day one a political movement that got a lot of bounce from Pat Robertson's run for the presidency and victory in Iowa, and then the snowball just kept getting bigger and bigger until it was too big for me to be in front of.
How did you first become involved in interreligious work?
Actually, my background before coming to the Interfaith Alliance was more in ecumenical work than it was in interfaith work. I know that some interfaith work early on was designated primarily as Jews and Christians talking to each other. In the sphere of religion from which I came, to have a Baptist go to a Presbyterian Thanksgiving service was a big achievement. But I found the great challenge in ecumenicity between Protestants and Catholics, and that was one of the major focuses of my outreach in an ecumenical ministry. When I came to the Interfaith Alliance, I was not that familiar with some of the religions that had been members of the Interfaith Alliance since the beginning. But one of my goals, encouraged by the board that called me to the Interfaith Alliance, was to expand our outreach so that we did indeed have, as part of the Interfaith Alliance, representatives of all of the great religions of the world. And then the next major step was finding a way for those people who are interested in religion and interested in religion's influence in the nation, but themselves are not affiliated with any religion. And I think we've made a lot of progress in that regard. We've not tried to define religion for anybody. And we have a lot of members now who don't claim any particular religion for their own, but who know that the relationship between religion and government is so important that it shapes much of the government's influence in our lives.
Could you talk about how you came to lead a national grassroots organization focused on defending religious freedom and also defending the concept of separation of church and state in an interfaith context?
You know, Ray, it's an interesting question. Looking back on it, when I came to the Interfaith Alliance, the first item on the strategic agenda was to get the name of the Interfaith Alliance in front of the American people and then help identify what our mission was all about. Because there had not been great public exposure to it, I started deliberately, intentionally, accepting every invitation that I got to speak on whatever the subject was. And if it was a media appearance, it was important to me to take it, whether it was at the center of our mission or not. And one of the very first major issues that I talked about was on an MSNBC program in which I was pitted against Jerry Falwell, and we were talking about the role of women in ministry, and I remember Falwell was going on and on pontificating about his views and what a great Baptist he was, and I said, Dr. Falwell, I'm sorry. I know that you've been invited to participate in Baptist conventions before, and you've always turned them down. And so I want you to know you're talking to a real Baptist who comes out of the historic Baptist tradition, and we're very much in disagreement with each other. For me, it was important to establish the fact that we were people who appreciated religion. We're not really ready to give up on religion, but we also wanted religion to maintain its integrity. The Interfaith Alliance itself came out of concerns raised by the Christian Coalition and Pat Robertson's assumption that the Christian Coalition spoke for all the religions in the nation. And the intent of the founders was to say, no, not all religious people think the same way. Pat Robertson does not speak for us. I had to say, I'm a Christian, but the Christian Coalition is far away from my beliefs and my interest in civic society, civil society, and social ethics. And so that distinction had to be made. That was the foundation then for moving into the wider community. And it's been really one of the joys and one of the best educations of my life to encounter so many people from other religions with whom I found common ground and friendship and whom I consider to be trusted colleagues today.
Now, one thing a lot of folks may not know is that you also somehow maintain a pastoral ministry in Louisiana. Would you talk about that just a little bit?
Yeah, I serve a church in Louisiana that was a new church. It was a church that came out of, in part, the schism that had gone on in the Southern Baptist Convention. We started out, and that church actually is still being members of the SBC, but it got so bad, and we were so embarrassed by being a part of it that we withdrew. And I think it would be hard to know who was happier the day we withdrew, whether it was me or whether those we withdrew from, because they were equally pleased by our decision, I think. When the invitation came to become the leader of the Interfaith Alliance, I resigned from the congregation and had every intent of moving to Washington and staying just here. But when I got to Washington, I found that there are a lot of people in this city who talk about religion and really don't know much about religion. People who talk about houses of worship and do not have the experiences about how houses of worship make decisions and engage in ministries that is helpful. And so that was going on in my mind at that same period of time. The search committee for a new pastor for Northminster Church came back and said, would you be willing to come as preaching for pastor and worship? We'll get another minister or two to do.
Take that line again. You said preaching for pastor and worship.
Right? Oh, I did. Okay. Came to during that same time, members of the search committee to get a new pastor for Northminster came to me and said, would you be willing to come back to Northminster most weekends, at least maybe 5 out of 6 or something like that, and serve as pastor for preaching and worship and continue your work with the Interfaith Alliance? Well, that was really a welcome invitation for me. I love congregational life. And I was of the firm opinion that maintaining my relationship to that congregation would be good for the work that I needed to do for the Interfaith Alliance, because we wouldn't be talking about religion theoretically. It would still be experientially for me. I would have one foot in the nation's capital, and I would also have a foot in a local community that was by whatever measurement miles and miles away from the nation's capital. And I have to say, I think that's still true. I made a deal with the church that if I thought that this ministry was hurting the church, I would end it. And if it was hurting me, I would end it. But we have found a mutual enjoyment and fulfillment in it, and so I think it was a good decision. One of the great joys of my life was that one weekend when I was gone, and there was a business meeting in the congregation, and the church actually voted to make my interfaith ministry with the Interfaith Alliance to consider that a part of its mission as well. So it's been a really good experience, and I'm glad that both entities have been a part of my life.
Welton, in addition to leading Interfaith Alliance and your pastoral ministry, you're also a husband and a father. You found time to write over 20 books. What keeps you going at this pace, and what areas of the work do you find the most satisfying?
Some people would say insanity keeps me going in this work. There is a there's a deep passion within me, Ray, regarding the importance of religious freedom, which comes straight out of the historical Baptist tradition. That's something a lot of people don't know. It was always a real tenet of our belief that church and state remain separate. That came because many of my predecessors in the Baptist tradition before the First Amendment to the Constitution was drafted and accepted had been in jails up and down the Eastern Seaboard because they had refused to pay the tax for a license that would allow them to preach, as they said, preach the gospel and be ministers. So that passion was there. But I also had been really restless with some of the unchallenged beliefs and unchallenged biblical interpretations that had been right essential in my faith experience with my family and with the churches in which I had had experiences. And I always had thought that the tendency which comes into religion, seemingly in all religions, the tendency to say, well, actually, we're the only ones that's right, when you really look at it that way, and narrows down to where it's a small world. I had always thought that the very nature of religion should not be reductive. It should be expansive, and that the call to be a global citizen and to be involved in a faith that engaged an international world was important. Whether you call that progressive religion or whether you just call that really good religion. And those are issues that were burning inside, and they were issues that that drove me and have driven me over the last 15 or 20 years. And when that's the case, sometimes I get tired, obviously. I get tired. I get very tired. Sometimes I get very discouraged. But the fire that is within those commitments and interests is what keeps me going. And every time I try to think about, well, you know, things aren't going well, let's just kind of quit, I have the problem that, one, I am a Christian. Second, I am a person of faith. And third, I'm an American. And oddly, none of those will allow the thought of quitting to take up residence in me.
At the Walter Cronkite Faith and Freedom Award ceremony coming up on November 11th, you'll also be awarding the President's Award to Mitchell Gold for work defending faith and freedom. Would you talk about that, please?
Yeah, I will. We started the President's Award a few years back. It has not been given every year, but I wanted an opportunity to express affirmation and to give encouragement to people that were really doing very special work in this nation. Mitchell Gold is an outstanding businessman. He works with his business partner, Bob Williams, as a manufacturer of furniture that supplies people all over the United States and all over the world. But Mitchell also has an avocation to which he gives almost as much time but doesn't receive money for it, and that is working for GLBT rights in America and around the world. And Mitchell is very deserving of the President's Award and of many other awards, both publicly and privately. And honestly, though his public work is known, some of his best work has been private in sitting down with pastors of often fundamentalist churches and having conversations with them, challenging their hatred of him because he is a gay man, challenging the kind of gospel they preach that is non-inclusive, rather pushes him and his kind away. Those have been kinds of conversations that have changed in sometimes people's minds. Others have been hardened in their positions, but at least Mitchell knows that the conversation, the outreach came from him. And then he has been a prolific writer about GLBT issues. There's a great book on the crisis with teenagers growing up with the awareness that they are gay and not knowing how to relate that to their family and to their religious community and social community. And then he has been very effective in sitting down with media people across the country and giving them some insight into how best to talk about this issue and what is helpful and what is not. It's really a pleasure to be able to choose Mitchell for this award this year, and it will be a great joy to give him that award. I didn't say elsewhere in the interview, and I should say now, that to be associated by this award with the name of Walter Cronkite is an humbling experience. I also should say that one of the great gifts of my life was the friendship of Walter Cronkite and the ability to get to know him better, to get to learn from him and to see the kind of courage and values that he held. So in a setting that bears the name of one of the greatest journalists in America and a man who was known as the most trusted man in America, it will be a great evening to give Mitchell that award and for me to receive the Cronkite Faith and Freedom Award.
The Reverend Dr. C. Welton Gaddy is this year's recipient of the Walter Cronkite Faith and Freedom Award, to be given by Interfaith Alliance at a gala ceremony Sunday, November 11th in New York City. Mitchell Gold will be receiving the President's Award at that ceremony. Complete information is available at interfaithalliance.org. I'm State of Belief Radio producer Ray Kirstein, and that's all the time I've got. So, Welton, back to you.
Thank you.